Today we're very lucky to have with us as the speaker Dr. Ronald Pfeiffer. He is professor and vice chair of the Department of Neurology and director of the Division of Neurodegenerative Diseases at the University of Tennessee Health Sciences Center in Memphis. Dr. Pfeiffer got his undergraduate medical degrees at the University of Nebraska, where he was just telling me about the football teams at the high school level, putting up six-man teams instead of the 11. He then went to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, where he did his residency, and then returned to the University of Nebraska, where he rose through the ranks and to professor of the departments of neurology and pharmacology. And then about 12 years ago, he saw the light and he moved to Tennessee. And for those of you who are paying attention to the timing of that, about 12 years ago was the downslide of Nebraska's football fortunes. And Tennessee was really starting to move up. I think the timing was more than just coincidental. Dr. Pfeiffer has longstanding interest in a variety of areas of neurodegenerative diseases, particularly Parkinson's, and within Parkinson's. He's not just confined to the motor symptoms. Many of you will recognize Homer Simpson with his brain, and Homer's brain has a long, thin process leading to his stomach. And for those of us who know, Dr. Pfeiffer has a particularly long-standing interest in the interaction of the effects of Parkinson's, not just on motor function, but also on gastrointestinal function and on other non-motor symptoms of the illness. And I just listed here three volumes that Dr. Pfeiffer has recently edited, and I think from the titles of them, Parkinson's disease and non-motor dysfunction, neurogastroenterology, you get a sense of the breadth of Dr. Pfeiffer. What you don't get a sense of is how prolific he's been in his research endeavors, not only in these particular areas, but in trials of new clinical medications, in a whole variety of areas, ranging from genetics to neurogastroenterology. We're very delighted to have him with us, and if you please welcome Dr. Ronald Pfeiffer.
Thank you very much. Let me just take a second here to get things up and running. You picked an outstanding weekend to have a program. I drove down this morning and the weather was absolutely beautiful. Well, thank you, Dr. Deutsch. That was probably the nicest introduction I've ever had. And I've always thought it's very nice that you get introductions before you talk, because if you got them after you talk, it might be quite a bit different. I used to title my talk, as you see up on the screen, that stands for Features of Parkinson's Disease. You didn't know were Parkinson's Disease. But then somebody told me once that kind of looks like a Welsh road sign rather than a topic, and I sort of allowed that was true. And so I've changed the title to this. Although, in retrospect, a roadmap sign isn't a bad idea, because what we're going to do today is take a quick road trip through the non-motor features of Parkinson's disease to get through everything. We may be speeding at time, but hopefully the highway patrol won't stop us. Before I get into the actual talk, though, I have to bring up something. You know, Dr. Deutsch mentioned that I live in Tennessee now, but I grew up in Nebraska. And Nebraska often gets viewed as sort of an uninteresting, boring place. Tennessee doesn't have that problem, but Nebraska does. And in fact, a few weeks ago in the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, there was a story about a young man who had been a high school basketball star, scored 81 points in a game a few years ago, but I don't think he ever graduated from high school, got into trouble. As it turns out, he had moved to Nebraska because someone had told him that Nebraska was the most boring place on earth and that he wouldn't get into trouble there. Well, the occasion for the newspaper article was that he was getting out of the Nebraska State Penitentiary, so it obviously didn't work. But in the article, to add insult to injury, they quoted somebody from Iowa, no less, saying that Nebraska was so boring it made Iowa look like paradise. And that hurt. And so I've decided that every talk I give, I'm going to put in a little plug for Nebraska. And I got some information from the Nebraska Tourist Bureau that I thought I would show, just to show you. It's not as dull and uninteresting as you may think. This is the Nebraska Riviera, and it's balmy all through the winter. The fact that I was just in South Dakota 3 days ago and it was snowing there has nothing to do with the veracity of the sign. And here are the Nebraska Alps. Beautiful. In other lectures, I've called them the Red Hills of Nebraska, and talk about our Mount Rushmore that has Bob Devaney and Tom Osborne on it. But anyhow, I think most everybody here is familiar with the four cardinal features of Parkinson's disease: the tremor, the stiffness, the slowness in movement. The postural instability I purposely have separated because that's a late finding in Parkinson's disease. And in fact, if you develop problems with balance and falling at the onset of the disease, or even within the first year of having symptoms, you probably do not have typical Parkinson's disease, but rather have one of the other Parkinsonian conditions. But those are the four cardinal features. And I think most people are also familiar with the secondary motor features: the loss of facial expression, the soft voice, the stoop posture, the walking with knees flexed, with small shuffling steps, the small handwriting. I think most people are familiar with that. But that's really just the tip of the Parkinson's disease iceberg. There's much more that isn't so easily or readily seen, and these are the non-motor features of Parkinson's disease. And it's this below the waterline, if you will, part of Parkinson's disease that we're going to occupy ourselves with for the next 50 minutes or so. You can divide the non-motor features of Parkinson's disease into these six categories, and each of those contain several types of abnormalities, all of which are actually quite common in patients with Parkinson's disease. And I think those of you with Parkinson's disease and family members will see as we go through this that that actually is indeed the case. So we'll start out with abnormalities of sensation, and in specifically I'm going to talk about problems with sense of smell, problems with vision, and pain, all of which can occur in the setting of Parkinson's disease. By the way, do you have the slides with you in your handouts? Okay, good. It turns out that an impaired sense of smell is very common in patients with Parkinson's disease. Studies would suggest that 70 to perhaps even 90% of people with Parkinson's disease have some impairment of sense of smell. When we talk about impaired sense of smell, people with Parkinson's disease have, first of all, difficulty smelling things, but even when they know that there's an odor present, they may have difficulty identifying the odor. One of the peculiar aspects of the olfactory impairment is that it's not across the board. It tends to be selective, and it's not entirely clear why this is the case. But for instance, people with Parkinson's disease have particular difficulty smelling licorice, coconut, or banana, whereas they have no trouble at all smelling chocolate, strawberry, or onions. One other fascinating feature of the impairment of sense of smell, and perhaps a very important feature, is the fact that it can actually develop sometimes several years even before the appearance of the more typical motor features of Parkinson's disease. So you question, why in the world should someone with Parkinson's disease have trouble smelling? We tend to be taught in medical school, and I think we teach our patients, that Parkinson's disease is due to damage to dopamine neurons that have their cell bodies in the substantia nigra, at the top of the brainstem. And that's true, but that's not the whole picture. It turns out there are dopamine neurons in a lot of other places in the brain, and as it turns out, including areas of the brain that have to do with sense of smell. There are dopamine neurons in the olfactory tubercle and back here in the olfactory nucleus in the brain. And as it turns out, those dopamine neurons are probably damaged in Parkinson's disease, just like any other neurons are damaged, and that, in turn, in all likelihood, accounts for the impaired sense of smell. But coming back to this fact that impaired sense of smell appears early in the setting of Parkinson's disease, as I just mentioned, the classic thinking is that Parkinson's disease is due to disease starting in the substantia nigra up here at the top of the brainstem. doctors, there are two doctors, Brock. It's a husband and wife. They're neuroanatomists, I believe, in Germany. They have looked at a lot of brains of people who have died, not necessarily that had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, but died, and they looked at looked for the presence of this inclusion body called the Lewy body that's so characteristic of Parkinson's disease patients, and looked at a lot of brains and charted where those Lewy bodies first made their appearance. Now, I have to add as an aside that their theories are not accepted by everybody and are in some areas at least controversial, but what Drs. Brock and Brock have reported is that the earliest changes in Parkinson's disease are not up here in the substantia nigra, but actually occur down here at the bottom of the brain, where a variety of other nuclei that are important for autonomic function are, and we'll come back to that a little bit later. But in addition to that, the other area where they first make their appearance is right here, which is in the olfactory area of the brain. And so the appearance of impaired sense of smell prior to the development of motor features may well be explained by this phenomenon, and that has led some to suggest that impaired sense of smell, along with some other features, might be used as a way to diagnose Parkinson's disease earlier than we're able to diagnose it just by looking at motor function. What about impaired or abnormalities of vision in people with Parkinson's disease? It's not at all uncommon for a neurologist to hear their patients with Parkinson's disease come into the office and describe a variety of somewhat vague visual symptoms. People will often say, oh, I got tired eyes, or I have blurred vision. Sometimes they'll say they have double vision, not too often. They particularly may describe difficulty doing things up close, like reading. And what's particularly frustrating to them is that they have been to their optometrist or their ophthalmologist, and their eye exam is fine. Their visual acuity with glasses gets corrected to 20/20, and the ophthalmologist or optometrist says, you're fine, your vision's okay, your eyes are okay, you don't have cataracts, you should be seeing perfectly fine, and they say, well, but I'm not. And so they come to the neurologist and say, could it have anything to do with my Parkinson's disease? And the answer is, yeah, it could. And there are several reasons why it could. First of all, you have to remember that the muscles that move the eyes around are muscles like any other muscles in the body, and they're affected by rigidity and bradykinesia. In particular, it turns out, they have difficulty moving both eyes close together, which is what you have to do when you're reading something or doing anything up close. That's called convergence. And impaired convergence is very common in Parkinson's disease, and that may cause some difficulty focusing on things close. When you're reading, you also have to scan your eyes across the page like this, and they have to stay exactly together. Well, with rigidity and bradykinesia, that may not be done quite so precisely either, and that too may lead to some blurring of vision. There have been a number of studies that show that people with Parkinson's disease have impaired color vision. That probably doesn't contribute a whole lot to their sense of impaired vision, but this last thing I have here is very important, I think, in explaining the visual symptoms that people with Parkinson's disease have, and that's called impaired contrast sensitivity. When you go into the optometrist or ophthalmologist, they have you look at the eye chart where the letters start out big and then get tinier and tinier as they go to the bottom. That's the Snellen chart, and that's designed to see how well you can see small or tiny objects. This chart's a little bit different. The size of the letters is all the same, but as you go down the page, they get more and more faint. And this is testing for contrast sensitivity, the ability to perceive differences in contrast. And as it turns out, this is very frequently, significantly impaired in patients with Parkinson's disease. So they would have difficulty seeing this line, or maybe even that line. Now, if you're out at noontime on a bright, sunny day, contrast is very stark, and black and white are very easy to perceive. Impaired contrast sensitivity really rears its head as far as causing problems with vision in dim lighting where everything is shades of gray, and it's in those conditions that people with Parkinson's disease have particular difficulty. So driving at night, walking about your house in the middle of the night or in the evening hours, those are times when visual symptoms can be particularly troublesome. So you might ask the same question, why should someone with Parkinson's disease have problems with contrast sensitivity, problems with vision? Well, as it turns out, there are dopamine neurons in the retina, just like there are dopamine neurons in the olfactory area and other parts of the brain, and those neurons are being lost in Parkinson's disease just like they are in other areas. Others, like Dr. Bodis Wollner at SUNY Brooklyn, have suggested that there may be other abnormalities in other higher visual areas of the brain, although that's less well described. What about pain in Parkinson's disease? You know, when you talk to docs, they often say, nah, pain's not part of Parkinson's disease. It's all motor dysfunction. But if you talk to patients, pain is actually relatively common for people with Parkinson's disease. And it can occur in a variety of forms. Blair Ford, who is at Columbia University in New York, has divided pain into these five categories. The last one I have in green, because akathisia is a word that means a sense you're uncomfortable sitting still. You have to get up and move about. In some respects, similar to restless legs, but different and more classically more related to drugs that block dopamine function. But that's not, strictly speaking, a pain phenomena, so I've separated it out a little bit, whereas the other four are clearly pain. Of the other four, musculoskeletal or muscle-based pain is probably the most common type of pain that patients with Parkinson's disease experience. You know, if you carry something heavy for any long distance, you know how your arms start to ache, the muscles in your arms? Anytime you tighten up muscles for prolonged periods of time, they eventually will hurt. And if you think about it, people with Parkinson's disease, because of their rigidity, have tight muscles constantly. So it shouldn't be surprising that a good proportion of them do develop aches and pains in their muscles, not typically in the joints. If a person is having pain that clearly is related to joints, it's likely arthritis and not related to Parkinson's disease. But if it's in the muscles, odds are that it's part of the Parkinson's disease and may respond to more vigorous treatment of the Parkinson's disease symptoms themselves. Because of changes in posture, because of age itself, people with Parkinson's disease are more prone to develop pinched nerves from slipped discs or from arthritic changes in their spinal column than would other people their age perhaps be. People with Parkinson's disease also can develop, particularly when the benefit of a dose of medicine wears off, they can develop a sustained contraction of multiple muscles in a limb or in their neck that put that limb in an odd, painful position, particularly if that spasm is prolonged. That's called dystonia, and that can be quite painful. Where it's most commonly occurring in people with Parkinson's disease is when they wake up in the morning, having gone the longest period of time without any medication. They tend to develop spasms or cramps or dystonia, more properly, in their foot, where the foot will turn in like this, or their toes might curl under or even curl up, the big toe up. And that can be quite uncomfortable, and it often goes away after they take their first dose of medication. The final category for pain is called central pain, and it's central in the sense that the source of the disturbance is not in the muscles, it's not in the nerves or nerve roots. It's probably deep within the brain itself, perhaps in an area called the thalamus. We really don't know. But people who have central pain often have rather bizarre, exceedingly disagreeable pain affecting odd locations like genital pain, rectal pain, pain deep in their mouth. This doesn't respond to nerve blocks. It doesn't respond to muscle relaxants. It often doesn't respond to conventional analgesic or pain relief medicines and can be a tremendously difficult management problem for patients, for family members, and for physicians. Fortunately, this is a very rare phenomenon, but for those few people who develop this pain, it really can be disruptive to them. Let's go on and talk about behavioral dysfunction. This is the aspect of non-motor dysfunction that receives the most attention in the medical literature, and in a large degree with good reason. There are a variety of behavioral abnormalities that have been described in the setting of Parkinson's disease. I have them listed here, and we'll go through them. For many years, in fact, for a century perhaps or more, there have been individuals that describe what has been come to be known as a Parkinsonian personality. That is, there is this suggestion that people who go on to develop Parkinson's disease have for many, many years prior to the development of their Parkinson's symptoms, and maybe lifelong, displayed certain personality characteristics. These are the types of characteristics that you'll find in the literature describing the Parkinsonian personality. And if you look at them, some of them are you know, good ones to have. Industrious, stoic, even-tempered, punctual. On the other hand, there are some that maybe aren't quite so complementary, inflexible, rigid, introverted, so on and so forth. Now, you can be thinking among yourselves whether those of you in the room with Parkinson's disease fit that personality or not, and I would wager that a good number of you will, but I will also wager that not everybody will. There are people with Parkinson's disease that don't fit this description at all, and there are people in this room without Parkinson's disease who may fit this description to a T. And it's that sort of variability that has led many people to believe that there really isn't any Parkinsonian personality at all. But I think it's interesting to speculate on it. It's something that you do hear about and read about, and you can decide for yourself whether you fit the description. Perhaps more important are the things I'm going to talk about the next few minutes. Depression is probably the most common behavioral abnormality or psychiatric abnormality that patients with Parkinson's disease experience. About 40%, well, I take that back, about 50% of people with Parkinson's disease experience some problem with depression at some point during the course of their illness. Like impaired sense of smell, depression can actually develop before the motor features appear. So within months or even several years before the appearance of motor features, people with Parkinson's disease may have experienced problems with depression. And about 40% of the time, that's been the case when it's been studied that way. The depression of Parkinson's disease isn't just related to increasing disability, that people are becoming depressed because they're able to do less. It can occur early, it can occur later. It doesn't bear any correlation to disease duration or severity. There have been a number of studies that suggest that it is related to chemical deficiencies, not so much the dopamine that we attribute or tie in with the motor disturbances of Parkinson's disease, but rather with several other chemicals, in particular serotonin and norepinephrine. This has treatment implications because the drugs that we use to treat depression conventionally are drugs that often impact serotonin and norepinephrine, and they too presumably are effective in treating depression in patients with Parkinson's disease. How effective and which ones are the most effective are still unanswered questions, and in fact, there's a research study. I don't know, Tom, are you guys part of SAD-PD? But there is an NIH-sponsored research study going on trying to identify which of two medicines, at any rate, might be more effective in treating Parkinsonian depression. There are some peculiar things, or not peculiar, but different things about depression in Parkinson's disease compared to the more typical depression that you might have in, say, a young woman or someone else without Parkinson's disease. Unlike those types of depression where guilt feelings, tearfulness, sadness are prevalent, the depressed person with Parkinson's disease tends not to be so ridden with guilt, but rather becomes more pessimistic, perhaps apathetic. Anxiety can be a big feature of depression in patients with Parkinson's disease. People with Parkinson's disease often experience aches and pains and other physical symptoms as a manifestation of their depression rather than just sadness. Despite the prevalence of depression in Parkinson's disease, suicide attempts have been very unusual. They do occur, but are very unusual. And one other interesting phenomenon about depression is that it can wax and wane in accordance with how the medicine is working. So when a person is on, when their Sinemet or other medication is working well, they feel pretty good. But when they drop into an off period, the depression kind of rises up and can take over, then receding when they take their next dose of medicine and turn back on again. And so you can have this fluctuating mood during the day that correlates with on and off motor fluctuations. Apathy is another behavioral abnormality that's being increasingly recognized as part of Parkinson's disease. Apathy itself is a term that refers to to a person having reduced emotion, less motivation, lack of initiative, all of these things that you can see with depression also. But what differentiates apathy from depression is that the depressed person is upset, sometimes even distraught, that they don't have the energy, they don't have the motivation to do things they want to do. The apathetic person doesn't care that they aren't doing these things. And I have to tell you, that can be especially aggravating and frustrating, not for the patient, because they don't care, but for their spouse, for their caregivers. And I not infrequently hear spouses complain that, golly, he or she can do this, but just doesn't want to do it, and it makes me so mad. And so apathy is something that's important to recognize, that it's not just the patient being obstreperous or difficult, it's actually a behavioral abnormality that's part of the Parkinson's disease. Apathy in studies has been present in anywhere from about 15 to 40% of people with Parkinson's disease. The higher figure probably includes people where apathy and depression are mixed, whereas the lower figure probably refers more to people with apathy and no obvious depression. But in any case, it is a common phenomenon. It's not simply a reaction to increasing disability, just like depression isn't a reaction to increasing disability. And as I mentioned earlier, it really can cause problems with caregivers and family members. Like depression, apathy can wax and wane with motor fluctuations, with on and off time. And a person, as they wear off, may become very apathetic, but when they're on, they're really raring to get up and do things. Joel Friedman, who is at Brown University in Rhode Island, has documented testosterone deficiency in some males with apathy. Whether one should treat that with testosterone replacement is a bit controversial because of the potential problems of long-term testosterone replacement. Anxiety is another feature, behavioral feature, that is being increasingly recognized as a common phenomenon in patients with Parkinson's disease. About 40% of people with Parkinson's disease will have difficulty with depression. I'm sorry, with anxiety. Often they are also depressed, but they don't have to be. You can have anxiety as a standalone problem. As with the other things I've been talking about, it doesn't correlate with disease severity. It can occur early. It can occur late. It can occur in people who are doing well from a motor standpoint. It can occur in people who are doing badly. It also, and perhaps even more than the others, can appear as a wearing off phenomenon. And so it's not uncommon that you see people who are fine when they're on, but as they wear off, they become progressively more anxious. They may develop shortness of breath. They may develop chest pain. They may develop a full-blown panic attack and end up in emergency rooms where they get evaluated to rule out a myocardial infarction to make sure nothing else is going on physically. But when they take the next dose of medicine and turn back on again, their symptoms go away. People become it's very uncomfortable to have a panic attack, and they become very sensitive to not wanting to develop those off-phenomenon anxiety attacks. And the way to treat that, if there's clearly that pattern relating to motor fluctuations, is to adjust Parkinson medicine, not to load people up with benzodiazepine drugs like lorazepam, Ativan, or Xanax, alprazolam. On the other hand, if the pattern isn't there, that it's a wearing off phenomenon, if it's occurring independently or if it's occurring in someone who doesn't have motor fluctuations, then benzodiazepine drugs may well be appropriate and used cautiously in patients with Parkinson's disease. Cognitive impairment or dementia, difficulty with thinking and memory, is something that when James Parkinson wrote his treatise back in 1817, he said it wasn't present in Parkinson's disease, and that's probably because he didn't get to see very many people, plus there was no effective treatment and people didn't live very long with Parkinson's disease. Nowadays, people with Parkinson's disease have almost a normal life expectancy, and as people with Parkinson's disease live longer, it's become increasingly recognized that a certain percentage of them do experience significant problems with memory and thought processes. In the literature, you'll see figures anywhere from 0 to 90%. The preponderant figures, though, come in around 20%, and maybe that should go up to 40%. Unlike the other things I've mentioned previously, cognitive impairment or dementia is something that clearly is related to disease duration and severity. In fact, one study suggests or showed that if you looked at people who had Parkinson's disease diagnosed for 5 years, maybe 15 to 20% had some problems with thinking and memory, whereas if you looked at people 10 years in, almost 40%. And if you looked beyond that, perhaps the percentage would go even higher. A good number, additionally, may have more mild problems with memory that are aggravating but certainly not disabling. The memory problems that people with Parkinson's disease experience are different from those of, say, with Alzheimer's disease. In Alzheimer's disease, the memory tracks are gone. The hard drive is erased, if you will. In Parkinson's disease, the memory traces are there. The problem is in accessing them. Now, that leads to the phenomena that if you cue people with Parkinson's disease, if you give them hints, often they will remember things, whereas the person with Alzheimer's disease, cueing doesn't help. People with Parkinson's disease also have what is called executive dysfunction. That is, they have difficulty making decisions. They have difficulty multitasking. They have difficulty doing more than one thing at a time. Difficulty dividing and shifting attention. So that's different from people with Alzheimer's disease. So the dementia of Parkinson's disease is not the same, and it's often mistaken by patients and even by some physicians as being the same as Alzheimer's, and it really isn't. Having said that, we still will treat the cognitive problems that patients with Parkinson's disease may develop with the same medicines that are used to treat Alzheimer's disease, but that doesn't mean that your doctor thinks you have Alzheimer's disease. It's just that those medicines may also be effective in treating the memory problems of the Parkinson patient. Now, the last item under behavioral dysfunction is labeled dopamine-induced behavioral dysfunction, and that's because these things are really not part of the disease process itself, per se, but are produced by the medications we use to treat Parkinson's disease. And there are two things I want to mention or talk about briefly. The first is called, by this fancy name, dopamine dysregulation syndrome. And the way to think about that is that these are people, and it's relatively rare, thank goodness, these are people that basically become addicted to the levodopa, to the Sinemet. Now, you have to remember that dopamine is the neurotransmitter our brain uses to signal reward. And cocaine, for instance, works on dopamine. And so it shouldn't be surprising that some of these types of problems develop in people. And perhaps the surprise is that it doesn't develop more often. But people who develop dopamine dysregulation syndrome are people that want to be on medicine. They always want more medicine. They may go to multiple docs, get multiple prescriptions. They don't take what they're supposed to take, they'll take more, and when the doc asks them to cut back or when their spouse asks them to cut back, they hide medicine around the house and continue taking it because when they're taking lots of medicine, they feel great. In fact, they feel euphoric. They're high. Whereas when they wear off, they feel weighed down. They feel dysphoric, and it's an uncomfortable, very difficult feeling that they go to great lengths to avoid. When they are euphoric and on, they can display all sorts of impulsive and compulsive behavior. I had one patient who took off bought a car, wrecked the car, was finally found by the police down in Mississippi, didn't quite know how to get back home, and he was a person with this sort of problem. And it occurs, it can be very disruptive, it can be very difficult to treat in the sense that the way to treat it is to reduce medication, but the patients are very resistant to having their medication reduced. The other medication-induced phenomenon that's received a lot more press is problems with impulse control. In particular, pathological gambling has received a lot of press, but people with Parkinson's disease have also been reported to display other compulsive behaviors, pathological shopping. I have one patient who buys exercise equipment on the internet. Now, his wife has developed the coping practice that she just sends it back when it arrives, and so it works out, but that happens. Abnormal sexual behavior, visiting prostitutes, other things have been described. Compulsive eating with significant weight gain. I have several patients where that's happened. Hobbyism. I have one patient who has taken up photography and carries his camera with him everywhere he goes, including to my visits. And when I walk in the room, he's invariably taking pictures of posters in the room. I've decided that's probably path. It's beyond the typical hobby and is probably related to his medication, but it's a fairly benign thing. I suspect it irritates his family, but it's a benign thing, and he's doing well on his medication, so we leave that alone. What about sleep disturbances? Also very common. I want to mention two in particular. Insomnia is present to some degree in virtually almost everybody with Parkinson's disease. Figures would suggest anywhere from about three-fourths to virtually 100%. People with Parkinson's disease have difficulty getting to sleep. They have difficulty staying asleep. The most common insomnia-related abnormality is called sleep fragmentation, and these are people who get to sleep okay. Maybe they even have some difficulty getting to sleep, but then they wake up again. They can go back to sleep, but then they wake up again. They go back to sleep and repeat this pattern throughout the night. And the problem with that is that they never really get into the deep, restful, restorative sleep. And when the morning comes, even though they may have slept intermittently through the night, they have really not rested and are drowsy during the daytime hours. This is very common. It can occur early on, and there are a lot of reasons why it can occur. Part of it just may be advancing age itself, but then there are other things, particularly in men, the need to urinate, perhaps because of an enlarged prostate, because of the Parkinson's itself, can keep getting people up at night so that they never get fully to sleep. Depression can play a role in this, what I call impaired turnability. As you're not taking medicine at night, you become more stiff, more rigid, have more difficulty turning and moving in bed. And if you don't move around, that leads to pressure points and discomfort, and that in turn may awaken people. A variety of other things, including medications, can interrupt the sleep patterns and lead to this sleep fragmentation also. And in trying to treat this problem, it's very important that patients and physicians work through the list of potential problems that might be causing it, so that if you can identify one of these problems, you can more directly try and treat it. The other abnormality I want to mention, because it's very treatable and potentially a serious abnormality, is called REM sleep behavior disorder. REM stands for rapid eye movement sleep. This is dream sleep. Normally when we dream, our muscles become limp. It's like God put a switch in there that when we go to sleep, we're not able to move, so we can watch the movie, so to speak, that our dream is without acting it out. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because a lot of our dreams involve violent, action-packed things, running from dangerous animals, jumping out of the way of trains, fighting bad guys. And if you could respond to that with movement, bad things might ensue. Well, it turns out, with REM sleep behavior disorder, that switch doesn't get flipped, and people indeed can move when they're dreaming. And so these people may, when someone's coming at them, they may slug them, but what they end up slugging, or who they end up slugging, is their spouse, or they may kick their spouse, thinking they're kicking who knows what else, or they may jump out of bed because a train is coming at them. And that sounds kind of humorous, but if you think about it, it's potentially dangerous. You can break someone's nose if you whack them at night when they don't know it's coming. If you jump out of bed, you can fall and break a hip, or you can whack your head on the bedside stand. And so REM sleep behavior disorder is potentially dangerous. It's important to bring that up to your neurologist or your physician if you're experiencing those problems, or if your spouse says you're experiencing. I should mention that patients aren't aware they're doing this. They're asleep. And so come morning, their spouse may say, "Hey, you hit me last night." And I did not. I was sound asleep. And they're both right. And so if that's happening, bring that up to your physician, because it's treatable with a drug called clonazepam or Klonopin. If there's some question that it's not clear that a person is having REM sleep behavior disorder, you can do an all-night sleep study, a polysomnogram, and it will show this sort of pattern. These two leads are eye movements, and you can see they're moving. So the eyes are moving, which means the person's dreaming, and these two leads, which are hooked up to muscles, should be flat during dream sleep, but you can see they're not flat. The person is moving, and that's how the sleep doc would identify REM sleep behavior disorder. Okay, breathing abnormalities in Parkinson's disease. Once again, when we breathe, part of our breathing is generated by the muscles bringing the ribs out and then letting them come back again, and then also the diaphragm expanding and contracting. Well, the muscles in the rib cage are muscles like anything else in the body, and they become rigid and bradykinetic in people with Parkinson's disease. And the net result is that people with Parkinson's disease tend to breathe more shallowly and thus more frequently. That can lead to less complete filling of the lungs. That can perhaps leave people at more risk for developing pulmonary problems. It also can... There can be some incoordination in this respiratory breathing process that can lead to fatigue in people with Parkinson's disease. And finally, occasionally even the upper airway can become obstructed or partially obstructed. And then, to turn things around, if a person is overtreated and has developed involuntary movements, sometimes those involuntary movements can involve the chest wall muscles and produce difficulty breathing, and the term dyskinetic dyspnea has been given to that. Those types of abnormalities may be ameliorated to some degree by adjustment of anti-Parkinson medication, but probably not completely so. I want to spend most of the rest of the time talking about autonomic dysfunction in Parkinson's disease. The autonomic nervous system is the part of our nervous system, and it's both within the brain and out in the nerves that go to various organs, but it's the part of the nervous system that handles the routine things that we don't have to consciously think about. It's the part of the nervous system that handles our heart rate, our blood pressure. It handles digestion. It handles bowel function. It handles bladder function. It handles sexual functioning. It handles temperature regulation. So it's very, very important for us, but we don't have to consciously think about it. As it turns out, the autonomic nervous system is clearly involved in people with Parkinson's disease, and all aspects can be involved. This was work that Farhan Siddiqui, who was a resident at UT a number of years ago, did when he was there, where he asked a group of patients with Parkinson's disease here in blue and their spouses in purple whether they were experiencing various autonomic symptoms. These columns all refer to individual types of abnormalities, but look over here where he summed them all up, and you can see that people with Parkinson's disease experience far more autonomic symptoms of a variety of types than do their spouses. And let's work through what type of problems they experience. I want to talk about three things. First of all, it's been clearly demonstrated now that there are two parts to the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. The sympathetic part of the autonomic system prepares us for fighting or running. It shunts blood to the muscles and to the brain so we can think and act. The parasympathetic part of the nervous system does the opposite. It shunts blood to the mesenteric vessels that supply the gut, and it's the type that becomes predominant after we've had a big meal. It relaxes and rests, reposes you. In patients with Parkinson's disease, the sympathetic supply to the heart is impaired and in many respects almost completely gone. Now, that doesn't lead to increased heart attacks or increased cardiac arrhythmias in patients with Parkinson's disease, but it may, it's not entirely clear to me, it may lead to changes in blood pressure with respect to orthostatic hypotension. This sort of illustrates what we're talking about. MIBG is a chemical that can be given in a scan. It attaches to sympathetic nerve endings, and so you get an outline of places where the sympathetic nervous system is active. This is the liver over here, but what I point your attention to is right here. This is the heart, in particular the left ventricle, and this is a person without Parkinson's disease. If you did this same scan in someone with Parkinson's disease, this area would be gone. It would be, you know, like the red background. Now, as I mentioned, that doesn't clearly lead to symptoms that you have to treat, but it may be useful in diagnosing Parkinson's disease, and in particular, it may be useful in separating Parkinson's disease from other Parkinson conditions. And this illustrates this. This is more work from Dr. Goldstein, who's at the NIH. Here you have this HM is just sort of think of that as the amount of yellow that you see, the amount of uptake that you see. And it's at this level in people who don't have any disease process at all. If you look at other conditions that can be confused with Parkinson's disease, here we have people with essential tremor. They're normal. Here you have people who've had multiple tiny strokes and have developed some Parkinsonian features, probably in particular difficulty walking. that's called vascular Parkinsonism, their levels are also normal. And perhaps most surprisingly, here you have people with multiple system atrophy. These are people who develop Parkinsonian features, some other features, but in particular, they develop problems with their autonomic nervous system and can have severe drops in blood pressure, severe abnormalities of bowel and bladder dysfunction and sexual dysfunctioning. But yet, when you do an MIBG scan on them, the level's normal. And the reason it's normal is because the abnormalities in MSA are all within the brain, whereas in Parkinson's disease, where the level is abnormal, in Parkinson's disease, the problem in the autonomic nervous system is both within the brain and in those peripheral autonomic nerves. And so this is a test that at some point in time, it isn't now, but at some point in time, it could conceivably come into more use as a helpful means to differentiate Parkinson's disease from other conditions, in particular MSA. What about orthostatic hypotension? That's a fancy word for the fact that your blood pressure drops when you stand up. It's not supposed to drop, and it typically doesn't in people who are well. But in people with Parkinson's disease, about 60% have a drop in their blood pressure when they stand up. Now, the majority of those people don't experience any problems because of that drop in blood pressure, but a minority of people do. Now, I was taught when I was a neurology resident that those drops in blood pressure were not due to the disease process itself, but were due to medicines that we were using to treat Parkinson's disease. That's not entirely true. Certainly medicines like Sinemet, like dopamine agonists, can drop the blood pressure, but you can see this drop in blood pressure withstanding in people who aren't on any treatment at all. And just because you see a drop in blood pressure doesn't mean you have MSA. Sometimes docs make that mistake too. Another important thing to remember is that although the typical symptom that someone experiences when they have orthostatic hypotension is that they get woozy or lightheaded or feel like they might faint, or if it drops enough, they may actually go on and faint when they stand up. But other features, other symptoms also can occur when the blood pressure drops and may lead you to miss the fact that it's occurring. For instance, people with orthostatic hypotension may simply find that their vision gets blurred when they stand up, improves when they sit back down. They may find that their thinking just gets foggy when they stand up. And again, it's okay if they sit down or lie down. Other people may experience headache, and classically it's a headache involving the neck and the shoulders, or they may experience pain in their rear end. Now, that's a little different than when you call your spouse a pain in the rear end. And in this case, it's probably due to impaired blood flow to those parts of the body because of, again, disturbances in the way the blood flow is being regulated. Or people may simply find that they get lethargic or fatigued when they stand up as a manifestation of their orthostatic hypotension. So if you notice those things, be sure and mention them to the doc and mention that you notice it specifically when you're standing up and it gets better when you lay down, and that may lead him or her to actually measure blood pressure with you lying and standing. Another aspect of this is called postprandial hypotension, and that's fancy for meaning that your blood pressure tends to drop after you eat a big meal. Again, it's not supposed to do that, but in people where their autonomic regulation isn't quite up to snuff, this may happen. It typically will happen after a large carbohydrate meal. When it does happen, it tends to occur about 15 minutes after the meal, and then it may last anywhere up to 3 hours before returning to normal. And during that time, people may become lightheaded when they stand up, but they may also experience all of these other symptoms that I just mentioned. This next slide is from Chris Mathias in London, and it sort of illustrates what I've been saying. In the gray are people without Parkinson's disease. This is their systolic, the upper of the two pressures. Here's the lower. Here they eat a meal, and you can see nothing really happens. That's the way it's supposed to be. The black dots are people with autonomic failure, with Parkinsonism. They're fine before they eat, but as soon as they eat this meal, about 15 minutes later, you see that their blood pressure has dropped significantly. Before the meal, it was 130 over 70 on average, and after the meal, it dropped to something like 70 over 40, and that's certainly low enough to produce symptoms. So if you notice that pattern in yourself or in your spouse, be sure and mention that to your doc. What about gastrointestinal dysfunction in Parkinson's disease? Turns out that there are a number of abnormalities of GI function that occur in the setting of Parkinson's disease and can actually be quite common. This is work that was done with Eamon Quigley and Lorraine Edwards when I was at the University of Nebraska. And you can see just how common these problems are. 70% of people with Parkinson's disease have too much saliva in their mouth, not because they make more saliva, but because they don't swallow as frequently. 50% roughly of people with Parkinson's disease will say they have difficulty swallowing. However, if you do fancy testing on them, what's called a modified barium swallow, that number jumps all the way up to 80 or even 90% have at least some abnormality of swallowing. And that shouldn't be surprising because the act of swallowing involves the coordinated action of a good number of muscles that has to occur rapidly in exactly the correct sequence. And if there's stiffness and slowness in any or all of those muscles, that can become an uncoordinated, slow phenomenon that lends itself to difficulty swallowing and also lends itself to food or water or any liquid going down the wrong tube, that is the windpipe rather than the esophagus. People with Parkinson's disease can have trouble with nausea. We think of that typically as occurring as a response to medications, which it usually is, but it also can occur in the setting of just Parkinson's disease itself. And in that setting, it's related to impaired emptying of the stomach, so-called gastroparesis. The most prevalent problem, though, is bowel dysfunction, and that can be divided into two types. We'll come to that in a bit. But I want to reinforce for a moment that the problems with bowel dysfunction and probably with GI dysfunction overall are due to changes both within the brain, that is within the central nervous system, but also within the nervous system that lines the gut. That's called the enteric nervous system. Come back. I told you I would come back to this. This is that Brock diagram again. And remember that Dr. Brock said that Parkinson's disease actually starts down in the lower part of the brain stem. That's where other nuclei exist, like the dorsal motor nucleus or the vagus, which controls a parasympathetic function to a good part of the gut. And other nuclei in that lower part of the brainstem have to do with autonomic function. And so it shouldn't be surprising that there is a gastrointestinal dysfunction in the setting of Parkinson's disease. But the enteric nervous system is also affected. This is a slide where Dr. Singerum, who was at the University of Wisconsin and did some work, again, with Dr. Quigley and I, did dopamine staining with a slice longitudinal-wise in the gut. And so these are dopamine neurons that have this fine network in a person without Parkinson's disease. If you did that in someone with Parkinson's disease, this is what you see. Those dopamine neurons are gone. And so, once again, dopamine deficiency, if you will, is present not only in the brain, but also in the enteric nervous system, and that may lead to difficulty with bowel function. One interesting sidelight is that in the Honolulu Heart Study, where the docs were following a group of veterans, Second World War veterans of Japanese descent, over many, many years, and tracking health in general, they were able to actually look at those veterans who developed Parkinson's disease and correlate bowel function with that. And they found that individuals, and these were men since they were veterans, men with a bowel movement frequency of fewer than one per day were 2.7 times more likely to develop Parkinson's disease than those men who had daily bowel movements, and were 4 times more likely to develop Parkinson's disease than those men who had 2 or more bowel movements a day. Now, it's not clear what that means. Could mean one of two things. It could mean that there's something, some toxin that gets absorbed from our GI system, that if it stays in the system longer, more of it gets absorbed and goes on to produce Parkinson's disease. On the other hand, it may also simply mean that this abnormality is yet another non-motor feature that was present long before the motor features of Parkinson's disease ever developed. There are two aspects to bowel dysfunction in patients with Parkinson's disease, infrequent defecation and difficulty with defecation. Infrequent or less frequent defecation means that the person's having fewer than 3 bowel movements per week, you don't have to have one a day to be normal, according to gastroenterologists. If you use this definition, about 30% of people with Parkinson's disease have constipation. It's due to slowed passage of fecal material through the colon, and you can chart that and actually quantify that with something called a colon transit study, where you give people a capsule that contains tiny pellets that show up on X-ray, and you give them one capsule a day for 6 days and then do a flat plate of the abdomen and then count the pellets that are still there. In a normal person without Parkinson's disease, you won't see many pellets at all, whereas in a person with Parkinson's disease, you'll see lots of pellets peppered around, and then you can take that and count that and calculate a colon transit time. And in our work, we found that normal people had a colon transit time around 20 hours, whereas people with Parkinson's disease had a colon transit time around 44 hours. Other people have suggested that the figure may be even up here in the 70-hour range for a lot of people with Parkinson's disease. So that explains the decreased bowel movement frequency. That often responds to laxatives. The more common problem affecting about two-thirds of people is difficulty with the actual act of defecation. And this involves difficulty having the bowel movement, having to strain a lot to have the bowel movement, and it's due to incoordination of the rectal muscles, just like incoordination of the throat muscles can lead to difficulty swallowing, incoordination of the rectal muscles can lead to difficulty defecating, and then you can actually develop spasm of those muscles. And because it's not a problem of hurrying things through the colon, laxatives aren't particularly helpful for this. Just a quick illustration. These are the sphincter muscles, and then there's this muscle called the puborectalis muscle that are important in bowel function. Normally, the puborectalis muscle wraps around and sort of kinks the rectum. It produces what's called an anorectal angle. If a person has to go but can't, you're giving a lecture in front of a bunch of people, you got to hold it, and so that puborectalis muscle tightens up even more, makes a bigger kink. Then when you want to relax, you let that relax, and it straightens out the pipe, so to speak, so it can go out. Now, a person with Parkinson's disease, it doesn't always work that well. Here they've put we put some barium into the rectum, and you see this angle with produced by the puborectalis muscle tightening up. Here the person is tightening up even more, and you can see that angle gets tighter. Here he's relaxing and trying to have the bowel movement, but you can see that angle isn't coming out. It should move out from here to like this, and it doesn't do that, and the net result is that material doesn't get emptied, a person doesn't have a complete bowel movement. And that there isn't any proven good treatment for that. Sometimes people can have a bowel movement easier if they're on, they have more difficulty if they're off. We have used apomorphine occasionally in our studies we used apomorphine injections, and it did help some people, but we haven't ever gone on and done further studies with that. Urinary dysfunction is real common in patients with Parkinson's disease. Anywhere from about 40 to 70% of people with Parkinson's disease have problems with urination. And there are two types, irritative and obstructive problems. Here's the bladder. And the bladder is like a balloon, and the skin of the balloon is a muscle called the detrusor muscle. As it fills with urine, that muscle gets stretched, and eventually it sends a signal up to the brain saying, hey, I'm full, I gotta go. That can be suppressed if necessary, but at some point in time, this center in the brainstem, a lower brainstem, like we mentioned before, sends a signal down, hey, okay, sphincter's relaxed, time to go. Well, if you have an irritable bladder, this detrusor muscle sends messages up when it's not full, saying, hey, I'm full, I gotta go, when it's really not full. So it's overactive or hyperactive. On the other hand, the lazy bladder would be a detrusor muscle that doesn't respond even when it's supposed to, or sphincter muscles that don't relax when they're supposed to. So the irritative bladder, the one that contracts and sends messages up before it's really full, is the predominant abnormality in patients with Parkinson's disease, and this leads to frequent urination, the need to get to the toilet really quickly, and sometimes difficulty actually making it, and when the person does get there, they tend to urinate small amounts. On the other hand, the obstructive pattern produces a hesitancy when starting to urinate, a weak urinary stream, but it also can produce incontinence. So you can't always tell the two apart just from listening to people, and I will typically send people to a urologist where they can do testing that can actually tell you which of those problems is present because they're treated very differently. The irritable or hyperactive bladder is treated with drugs like ditropan, whereas the underactive bladder, if it's a prostate gland that's preventing outflow, of course you treat the prostate, but if it's other problems, you may even need to do intermittent catheterization. Sexual dysfunction hasn't been well studied, but it is certainly present. We've already talked about excessive or distorted function in the setting of medications because that's where you usually see it. But reduced function is quite common. In men, about 40 to 60% of men have erectile dysfunction, and over 40% have decreased libido or desire. Women have been studied much less frequently, but at least one study suggests there's reduced vaginal sensitivity in women, and an even higher number have decreased libido, and there are multiple reasons why that's the case. Erectile dysfunction in men can be treated with drugs like Viagra. You just have to be very careful about hypotension, about the blood pressure dropping. Finish up here with temperature regulation. Hasn't received a lot of attention, but it occurs, and there are two aspects to talk about: sweating, and then problems with temperature control. Bouts of sweating, typically involving the head and neck, are actually quite common in people with Parkinson's disease, about 50%. And they can become so severe that they drench people, they have to change their clothes. This most often occurs either when the medicine's wearing off or when people are really dyskinetic. And in those settings, you can try and treat that by adjusting their Parkinson's medication. But it also can occur independent of any motor fluctuations. And in those people, we don't have any real effective treatment yet. Beta blockers have been tried, anticholinergic drugs have been tried, but nothing seems to work well. It's harmless, aggravating, but harmless. On the other hand, abnormalities of temperature regulation are potentially serious. Drugs that boost dopamine, like dopamine agonists, can sometimes drop the body temperature. That's not much of a problem here in Tennessee, but if you're up in North Dakota in the middle of the winter, you need to be very careful about going outside in cold weather if you're on dopamine agonists or probably even Sinemet. On the other hand, suddenly stopping Sinemet or levodopa can produce a picture where the temperature can go way up, your autonomic nervous system can misbehave, and this can actually be lethal. People die from this phenomenon, so never suddenly stop your Sinemet or your other anti-Parkinson medication unless it's absolutely necessary to do so. I do have some slides on fatigue that I am not going to get to. You can look at them. Fatigue has not been well studied in the setting of Parkinson's disease hopefully will be more studied in future times. So that's a quick road trip through autonomic dysfunction in Parkinson's disease. Thank you very much.